of your boyfriend, yes? When you met Mr. Trewin, I didn't. When you met Mr. Trewin outside the halls of residence, I didn't meet. You told Mr. Trewin you were missing. We never talked. I put it to you, Miss Ellicott, that you were ashamed of inviting Mr. Trewin. I didn't invite. You had made a joke, Miss Ellicott, hadn't you, in the bar, about missing the, sexual attentions of... I said I missed. How many drinks had you had, Miss Ellicott? Robin understood only too well why people were scared of telling, of owning up to what had been done to them, of being told that the dirty, shameful, excruciating truth was a figment of their own sick imagination. Neither Holly nor Brittany had been able to face the prospect of open court, and perhaps Elisa and Angel would be scared away too. Yet nothing, Robin was sure, short of death or incarceration, would ever stop Noel Brockbank raping little girls. Even so, she would be glad to know that Shanker had not killed him, because if he had... "Shanker!" she shouted, as a tall, tattooed figure in a shell suit passed under a street lamp ahead.
"Come fucking find the bastard, Rob,"
came Shanker's echoing voice. He did not seem to realize that Robin had been sitting on a hard floor in terror for 2 whole hours, praying for his return.
"He can move for a big fucker, can't he?"
"The police will find him," said Robin, whose knees were suddenly weak. "Elisa's going to call them, I think. Shanker, will you... please, will you drive me home?" Chapter 55. Came the last night of sadness, and it was clear she couldn't go on. Blue Oyster Cult. Don't fear the Reaper. For 24 hours, Strike remained in ignorance of what Robin had done. She did not answer when he phoned at lunchtime the next day, but as he was wrestling with his own dilemmas and believed her to be safe at home with her mother, he neither found this strange nor troubled to call back. His injured partner was one of the few problems that he believed temporarily solved, and he did not intend to encourage her in thoughts of returning to his side by confiding in her the revelation he had experienced outside the hospital. This, however, was now his overriding preoccupation. After all, there was no longer any competition for his time or attention in the solitary, silent room where no clients called or visited. The only sound was the buzzing of a fly zooming between the open windows and hazy sunlight as Strike sat chain-smoking Benson and Hedges. As he looked back over the almost 3 months since the severed leg had been delivered, the detective saw his mistakes only too clearly. He ought to have known the identity of the killer after visiting Kelsey Platt's home. If he had only realized then, if he had not allowed himself to be taken in by the killer's misdirection, not been distracted by the competing sense of other deranged men, Lila Monckton would still have all 10 fingers, and Heather Smart might be safe at work in her Nottingham Building Society, vowing, perhaps, never again to be as drunk as she had been on her sister-in-law's birthday jaunt to London. Strike had not come up through the Special Investigation Branch of the Royal Military Police without learning to manage the emotional consequences of an investigation. The previous evening had been full of self-directed anger, but even as he castigated himself for not seeing what was right in front of him, he had acknowledged the killer's brazen brilliance. There had been an artistry in the way that he had used Strike's background against him, forcing Strike to second-guess and question himself, undermining his trust in his own judgment. The fact that the killer was indeed one of the men whom he had suspected from the first was cold comfort. Strike could not remember ever being in such agony of mind over an investigation as he was now. Alone in his deserted office, convinced that the conclusion he had reached had neither been given credence by the officer in whom he had confided it, nor passed on to Carver, Strike felt, however unreasonably, that if another killing occurred, it would indeed be his fault. Yet if he went near the investigation again, if he started stalking out or tailing this man, Carver would almost certainly see him in court for interfering with the course of a police investigation or obstructing the police in their inquiries. He would have felt the same way himself had he been in Carver's shoes. Except, thought Strike, with a rush of pleasurable anger, that he would have listened to anyone, however infuriating, if he thought they had a shred of credible evidence. You did not solve a case as complex as this by discriminating against witnesses on the grounds that they have previously outwitted you. Only when his stomach rumbled did Strike remember that he was supposed to be going out for dinner with Ellen that night. The divorce settlement and custody arrangements had now been finalized, and Ellen had announced over the phone that it was about time they enjoyed a decent dinner for a change, and that she had booked Le Gavroche. My treat. Alone, smoking in his office, Strike contemplated the forthcoming evening with a dispassion he was no longer able to bring to the thought of the Shacklewell Ripper. On the plus side, there would be excellent food, which was an enticing prospect given the fact that he was skint and had last night dined on baked beans on toast. He supposed that there would be sex, too, in the pristine whiteness of Ellen's flat, the soon-to-be-vacated home of her disintegrating family. On the minor side, he found himself staring the bald fact in the face as he had never done before. He would have to talk to her, and talking to Ellen, he had finally admitted to himself, was far from one of his favourite pastimes. He always found the conversation especially effortful when it came to his own work. Ellen was interested, yet strangely unimaginative. She had none of the innate interest in and easy empathy for other people that Robin displayed. His would-be humorous word portraits of the likes of two times left her perplexed rather than amused. Then there were those two ominous words, my treat. The increasing imbalance in their respective incomes was about to become painfully obvious. When Strike had met Ellen, he had at least been in credit. If she thought that he was going to be able to return the treat with dinner at Le Gavroche on another night, she was destined to be sorely disappointed. Strike had spent 16 years with another woman who had been far richer than he was. Charlotte had alternately brandished money as a weapon and deplored Strike's refusal to live beyond his means. Memories of Charlotte's occasional fits of pique that he could not or would not fund treats on which she had set a capricious heart made his hackles rise when Ellen spoke of having a decent dinner for a change. It had mostly been he who had footed the bills for French and Indian meals in out-of-the-way bistros and curry houses where Ellen's ex-husband had been unlikely to see them. He did not appreciate the fruits of his hard-earned cash being disparaged. His state of mind was not entirely propitious, therefore, when he headed off to Mayfair at 8 o'clock that evening, wearing his best Italian suit, thoughts of a serial killer still chasing each other around his overtired brain. Upper Brook Street comprised grand 18th-century houses, and the frontage of Le Gavroche, with its wrought iron canopy and ivy-covered railings, the expensive solidity and security implied by its heavy mirrored front door, was dissonant to Strike's uneasy frame of mind. Ellen arrived shortly after he had been seated in the green and red dining room, which was artfully lit so that puddles of light fell only where needed onto snow-white tablecloths over gilt-framed oil paintings. She looked stunning in a pale blue form-fitting dress. As he rose to kiss her, Strike momentarily forgot his latent unease, his disgruntlement. "This makes a nice change," she said, smiling, as she sank down onto the curved upholstered bench at their round table. They ordered. Strike, who craved a pint of Doombar, drank burgundy of Ellen's choosing, and wished, despite having smoked more than a pack that day, that he could have a cigarette. Meanwhile, his dinner companion launched into a barrage of property talk. She had decided against the strata penthouse and had now looked at a property in Camberwell, which seemed promising. She showed him a picture on her phone. Another columned and porticoed vision of Georgian whiteness met his tired eyes. As Ellen discussed the various pros and cons of a move to Camberwell, Strike drank in silence. He even begrudged the wine's deliciousness, throwing it back like the cheapest plonk, trying to blunt the edges of his resentment with alcohol. It did not work. Far from dissolving, his sense of alienation deepened. The comfortable Mayfair restaurant, with its low lighting and its deep carpet, felt like a stage set, illusory, ephemeral. What was he doing here, with this gorgeous but dull woman? Why was he pretending to be interested in her expensive lifestyle when his business was in its death throes and he alone in London knew the identity of the Shacklewell Ripper? Their food arrived, and the deliciousness of his fillet of beef did something to assuage his resentment. "So what have you been up to?" asked Ellen, punctiliously polite as usual. Strike now found himself presented with a stark choice. Telling her the truth about what he had been up to would necessitate an admission that he had not kept her abreast of any of the recent events that would have been deemed enough news for a decade in most people's lives. He would have been forced to reveal that the girl in the newspapers who had survived the Ripper's latest attack was his own business partner. He would have to tell her that he had been warned off the case by a man whom he had previously humiliated over another high-profile murder. If he were making a clean breast of all that he had been up to, he ought also to add that he now knew exactly who the killer was. The prospect of relating all this bored and oppressed him. He had not once thought to call her while any of these events had unfolded, which was revealing enough in itself. Playing for time while he took another sip of wine, Strike came to the decision that the affair had to end. He would make an excuse not to go back to Clarence Terrace with her tonight, which ought to give her early warning of his intentions. The sex had been the best part of the relationship all along. Then, next time they met, he'd tell her it was over. Not only did he feel it would be churlish to end things over a meal for which she was paying, there was a remote chance that she would walk out, leaving him with a bill that his credit card company would undoubtedly refuse to process.
"I haven't been up to much, to be honest," he lied.
"What about the Shackle?" Strike's mobile rang. He pulled it out of his jacket pocket and saw that the number had been withheld. Some sixth sense told him to answer it.
"Sorry," he said to Ellen. "I think I need to..." "Strike," said Carver's unmistakable South London voice. "Did you send her to do it?"
"What?"
said Strike. "Your fucking partner. Did you send her to Brockbank?"
Strike stood up so suddenly that he hit the edge of the table. A spray of blooded brown liquid spattered across the heavy white tablecloth. His fillet of beef slid over the edge of the plate, and his wine glass toppled, splashing Ellen's pale blue dress. The waiter gaped, as did the refined couple at the next table.
"Where is she? What's happened?" asked Strike loudly, oblivious to everything except the voice on the end of the line. "I warned you, Strike," said Carver, his voice crackling with rage. "I fucking warned you to stay away. You have fucked up royally this time."
Strike lowered the mobile. A disembodied Carver bellowed into the restaurant, the cunts and fucks clearly audible to anybody standing nearby. He turned to Ellen in her purple-stained dress, with her beautiful face screwed up in mingled perplexity and anger.
"I've got to go. I'm sorry. I'll call you later."
He did not stay to see how she took it. He did not care. Limping slightly, because he had twisted his knee in his haste to get up, Strike hurried out of the restaurant, phone to his ear again. Carver was now virtually incoherent, shouting Strike down whenever he attempted to speak.
"Carver, listen," Strike shouted, as he regained Upper Brook Street. "There's something I want to... Fucking listen, will you?"
But the policeman's obscenity-strewn soliloquy merely became louder and filthier.
"You fucking stupid fucking cunt, he's gone to ground. I know what you are fucking up to. We found it, you bastard. We found a church connection. If you ever... Shut your fucking mouth, I'm talking. If you ever come near one of my fucking investigations again..."
Strike slogged on through the warm night, his knee protesting, frustration and fury mounting with every step he took. It took him nearly an hour to reach Robin's flat in Hastings Road, by which time he was in full possession of the facts. Thanks to Carver, he knew that the police had been with Robin this evening, and were perhaps still there, interrogating her about the intrusion into Brockbank's house that had led to a report of child rape and the flight of their suspect. Brockbank's photograph had been widely disseminated across the force, but he had not, as yet, been apprehended. Strike had not warned Robin that he was coming. Turning into Hastings Road as fast as his limp would allow, He saw through the fading light that all the windows of her flat were lit. As he approached, two police officers, unmistakable even in plain clothes, emerged from the front entrance. The sound of the front door closing echoed down the quiet street. Strike moved into the shadows as the police crossed the road to their car, talking quietly to each other. Once they had pulled safely away, he proceeded to the white front door and rang the bell.
"Thought we were done," said Matthew's exasperated voice behind the door.
Strike doubted that he knew that he could be heard, because when he opened it, Robin's fiancé was wearing an ingratiating smile that vanished the moment he realized who it was.
"What do you want?"
"I need to talk to Robin," said Strike.
As Matthew hesitated, with every appearance of wishing to block Strike's entrance, Linda came out into the hall behind him.
"Oh,"
she said at the sight of Strike. He thought she looked both thinner and older than the previous time he had met her, no doubt because her daughter had nearly got herself killed, then turned up voluntarily in a violent sexual predator's house and got attacked all over again. Strike could feel the fury building beneath his diaphragm. If necessary, he would shout for Robin to come and meet him on the doorstep, but he had no sooner formed this resolution than she appeared behind Matthew. She too looked paler and thinner than usual. As always, he found her better looking in the flesh than in the memory he had of her when not present. This did not make him feel any more kindly towards her.
"Oh,"
she said, in exactly the same colourless tone as her mother.
"I'd like a word," said Strike.
"All right," said Robin, with a slightly defiant upwards jerk of her head that made her red-gold hair dance around her shoulders. She glanced at her mother and Matthew, then back at Strike. "Do you want to come into the kitchen, then?" He followed her down the hall into the small kitchen, where a table for two stood crammed into the corner. Robin closed the door carefully behind them. Neither sat down. Dirty dishes were piled by the sink. They had apparently been eating pasta before the police arrived to interrogate Robin. For some reason, this evidence that Robin had been behaving so prosaically in the wake of the chaos she had unleashed increased the rage now battling with Strike's desire not to lose control.
"I told you," he said, "not to go anywhere near Brockbank."
"Yes," said Robin in a flat voice that aggravated him still further. "I remember." Strike wondered whether Linda and Matthew were listening at the door. The small kitchen smelled strongly of garlic and tomatoes. An England rugby calendar hung on the wall behind Robin. The 30th of June was circled thickly, the words "Home for Wedding" written beneath the date.
"But you decided to go anyway," said Strike.
Visions of violent, cathartic action, picking up the pedal bin and throwing it through the steamy window, for instance, were rising chaotically in his mind's eye. He stood quite still, large feet planted on the scuffed lino, staring at her white and stubborn face. "I don't regret it," she said. "He was raping.
Carver's convinced I sent you. Brockbank's vanished. You've driven him underground. How are you going to feel if he decides he'd better cut the next one into pieces before she can blab?" "Don't you dare put that on me," said Robin, her voice rising. "Don't you dare. You're the one who punched him when you went to arrest him. If you hadn't hit him, he might have gone down for Brittany."
"That makes what you did right, does it?"
He refrained from shouting, only because he could hear Matthew lurking in the hall, however quiet the accountant thought he was being.
"I've stopped Angel being abused, and if that's a bad thing to do..." "You've driven my business off the edge of a fucking cliff," said Strike, in a quiet voice that stopped her in her tracks. "We were warned away from those suspects, from the whole investigation. But you went storming in, and now Brockbank's gone to ground. The press'll be all over me for this. Carver'll tell them I fucked it all up. They'll bury me. And even if you don't give a shit about any of that," said Strike, his face rigid with fury, "how about the fact that the police have just found a connection between Kelsey's church and the one in Brixton where Brockbank was attending?"
She looked stricken.
I didn't know.
Why wait for the facts? Asked Strike, his eyes dark shadows in the harsh overhead lighting. Why not just blunder in and tip him off before the police can take him in?
Appalled, Robin said nothing. Strike was looking at her now as though he never liked her, as though they had never shared any of the experiences that, to her, had constituted a bond like no other. She had been prepared for him to punch walls and cupboards again, even in the heat of his anger to...
We're finished, said Strike.
He took some satisfaction from the shrinking movement she could not hide, from the sudden blanching of her face.
You don't?
I don't mean it.
You think I need a partner who won't take instruction, who does what I've explicitly told her not to do, who makes me look like a troublemaking, egotistical prick in front of the police, and causes a murder suspect to disappear under the force's nose.
He said it in a single breath, and Robin, who had taken a step backwards, knocked the England rugby calendar off the wall with a rustle and thud she failed to hear, so loudly was the blood pounding in her ears. She thought she might faint. She had imagined him shouting, I ought to fire you. But not once had she considered that he might actually do it. That everything she had done for him, the risks, the injuries, the insights and the inspirations, the long hours of discomfort and inconvenience, would be washed away, rendered negligible by this one act of well-intentioned disobedience. She could not even get enough breath into her lungs to argue, because his expression was such that she knew all she could expect was further icy condemnation of her actions and an exposition of how badly she had screwed up. The memory of Angel and Elisa holding each other on the sofa, the reflection that Angel's suffering was finished and that her mother believed and supported her, had comforted Robin through the hours of suspense during which she had waited for this blow to fall. She had not dared tell Strike what she had done. Now she thought it might have been better if she had.
What?
She said stupidly, because he had asked her something. The noises had been meaningless.
Who was the man you took with you?
That's none of your business, she whispered, after a short hesitation.
They said he threatened Brockbank with a knife.
Shanker, said Strike,
light dawning only now, and in that instant she saw a trace of the Strike she knew in the reanimated, infuriated face.
How the fuck did you get Shanker's number?
But she could not speak. Nothing mattered beside the fact that she was fired. She knew that Strike did not relent when he decided that a relationship had run its course. His girlfriend of 16 years had never heard from him again after he had ended it, although Charlotte had tried to initiate contact since. He was already leaving. She followed him into the hall on numb legs, feeling herself to be acting like a beaten dog who still slinks after the Punisher, hoping desperately for forgiveness.
Good night,
Strike called to Linda and Matthew, who had retreated into the sitting room.
Cormoran,
Robin whispered.
I'll send you last month's salary on, he said, without looking at her. Quick and clean, gross misconduct.
The door closed behind him. She could hear his size 14s moving away up the path. With a gasp, she began to cry. Linda and Matthew both came hurrying into the hall, but too late. Robin had fled to the bedroom, unable to face their relief and delight that, at last, she would have to give up her dream of being a detective. Chapter 56. When life's scorned and damage done, to avenge, this is the pact. Blue Oyster Cult. Vengeance, the pact. 4:30 the following morning found Strike awake after virtually no sleep. His tongue ached from the amount of smoking he had done overnight at the formica table in his kitchen, while contemplating the decimation of his business and his prospects. He could barely bring himself to think about Robin. Fine cracks, like those in thick ice during a thaw, were starting to appear in what had been implacable fury, but what lay beneath was scarcely less cold. He could understand the impulse to save the child. Who couldn't?
Hadn't he, as she had so often injudiciously pointed out, knocked Brockbank out cold after viewing Britain's taped evidence? But the thought of her heading off with Shanker without telling him, and after Carver had warned them not to go anywhere near the suspects, made rage thunder through his veins all over again as he upended his cigarette pack and found it empty. He pulled himself to his feet, picked up his keys and left the flat, still wearing the Italian suit in which he had dozed. The sun was coming up as he trudged down Charing Cross Road, in a dawn that made everything look dusty and fragile, a grey light full of pale shadows. He bought cigarettes in a corner shop in Covent Garden and continued to walk, smoking and thinking. After 2 hours spent walking the streets, Strike reached a decision about his next move. Heading back towards the office, he saw a waitress in a black dress unlocking the doors to the Café Vergnano 1882 on Charing Cross Road, realized how hungry he was, and turned inside. The small coffee shop smelled of warm wood and espresso. As Strike sank gratefully onto a hard oak chair, he became uncomfortably aware that for the past 13 hours he had smoked ceaselessly, slept in his clothes, and eaten steak and drunk red wine without cleaning his teeth. The man in the reflection beside him looked crumpled and grimy. He tried not to give the young waitress any opportunity to smell his breath as he ordered a ham and cheese panini, a bottle of water, and a double espresso. As the copper-domed coffee maker on the counter hissed into life, Strike sank into a reverie, searching his conscience for a truthful answer to an uncomfortable question. Was he any better than Carver? Was he contemplating a high-risk and dangerous course of action because he really thought it the only way to stop the killer? Or was he inclining to the higher-stakes option because he knew that if he brought it off, if he were the one to catch and incriminate the murderer, it would reverse all the damage done to his reputation and his business, restoring him to the luster of a man who succeeded where the Met failed? Was it, in short, necessity or ego that was driving him towards what many would say was a reckless and foolish measure? The waitress set his sandwich and coffee in front of him, and Strike began to eat with the glazed stare of a man too preoccupied even to taste what he was chewing. This was as well publicized a series of crimes as Strike had ever come into contact with. The police would currently be flooded with information and leads, all of which needed following up, and none of which, Strike was prepared to bet, would lead anywhere near the real devious and successful killer. He still had the option of trying to make contact with one of Carver's superiors, although he was now in such poor odour with the police that he doubted he would be allowed direct speech with a superintendent, whose first loyalty would of course be to his own men. Trying to circumnavigate Carver would do nothing to diminish the impression that he was trying to undermine the head of the investigation. What was more, Strike did not have evidence, merely a theory about where the evidence was. While there was a remote chance that somebody at the Met might take Strike seriously enough to go looking for what he promised they would find, Strike feared that further delay might cost another life. He was surprised to find that he had finished his panini. Still extremely hungry, he ordered a second. No, he thought with sudden resolve. This is the way it's got to be. This animal needed to be stopped as soon as possible. It was time to get out ahead of him for the first time. However, as a sop to his conscience, as a proof to himself that he was motivated primarily by catching a killer rather than by glory, Strike took out his mobile again and called Detective Inspector Richard Anstis, his oldest acquaintance on the force. He was not on the best terms with Anstis these days, but Strike wanted to be certain in his own mind that he had done all he could to allow the Met the chance to do the job for him. After a long pause, a foreign dialing tone sounded in his ear. Nobody picked up. Anstis was on holiday. Strike debated leaving a voicemail and decided against. Leaving such a message on Anstis's phone when there was nothing the man could do would definitely ruin his holiday, and from what Strike knew of Anstis's wife and 3 children, the man needed one. Hanging up, he He scrolled absent-mindedly through his recent calls. Carver had not left his number. Robin's name sat a few rows beneath. The sight of it stabbed the tired and desperate Strike to the heart, because he was simultaneously furious with her and longing to talk to her. Setting the mobile resolutely back onto the table, he shoved his hand into his inside jacket pocket and pulled out a pen and notebook. Eating his second sandwich as fast as his first, Strike began to write a list. 1. Write to Carver. This was partly a further sop to his own conscience, and partly what he generally termed arse covering. He doubted the ability of an email to find its way to Carver, whose direct address he did not have, through the tsunami of tip-offs now sure to be pouring into Scotland Yard. People were culturally disposed to take ink and paper seriously, especially when it had to be signed for. An old-fashioned letter sent recorded delivery would be sure to find its way to Carver's desk. Strike would then have laid a trail just as the killer had done, demonstrating very clearly that he had tried every possible route to tell Carver how the killer might be stopped. This was likely to be useful when they all found themselves in court, which Strike did not doubt would happen whether or not the plan he had formulated, walking through the dawn in sleepy Covent Garden, was successful. 2. Gas canister. Propane? 3. Fluorescent jacket. 4. Woman. Who? He paused, arguing with himself, scowling over the paper. After much thought, he reluctantly wrote, 5. Shanker. This meant that the next item had to be 6. £500. From where? And finally, after a further minute's thought, 7. Advertise for Robin replacement. Chapter 57. Sole survivor, cursed with second sight, haunted savior, cried into the night. Blue Oyster Cult, sole survivor. 4 days passed. Numb with shock and misery, Robin at first hoped and even believed that Strike would call her, that he would regret what he had said to her, that he would realize what a mistake he had made. Linda had left, kind and supportive to the last, but, Robin suspected, secretly happy to think that Robin's association with the detective had ended. Matthew had expressed enormous sympathy in the face of Robin's devastation. He said that Strike did not know how lucky he had been. He had enumerated for her all the things she had done for the detective, foremost of which was accepting a laughably small salary for unreasonably long hours. He reminded Robin that her status as partner in the agency had been entirely illusory, and totted up all the proofs of Strike's lack of respect for her, the absence of a partnership agreement, the lack of overtime pay, the fact that she always seemed to be the one who made tea and went out to buy sandwiches. A week previously, Robin would have defended Strike against all such accusations. She would have said that the nature of the work necessitated long hours, that the moment to demand a pay rise was not when the business was fighting for its very survival, that Strike made her mugs of tea quite as often as she made them for him. She might have added that Strike had spent money he could ill afford, training her in surveillance and counter-surveillance, and that it was unreasonable to expect him, a senior partner, sole investor, and founding member of the agency, to place her on absolutely equal legal footing with himself. Yet she said none of those things, because the last two words that Strike had spoken to her were with her every day, like the sound of her own heartbeat. Gross misconduct. The memory of Strike's expression in that last moment helped her pretend that she saw things exactly as Matthew did, that her dominant emotion was anger, that the job which had meant everything to her could be easily replaced, that Strike had no integrity or moral sense if he could not appreciate that Angel's safety trumped all other considerations. Robin had neither the will or the energy to point out that Matthew had performed an abrupt volte-face on the last point because he had been furious initially when he had found out that she had gone to Brockbank's. As the days went by without any further contact from Strike, she felt unspoken pressure from her fiancé
to pretend that the prospect of their wedding on Saturday not only made up for her recent sacking, but consumed all her thoughts. Having to fake excitement while he was present made Robin relieved to be alone during the day while Matthew worked. Every evening before he returned, she deleted the search history on her laptop so that he would not see that she was constantly looking for news about the Shacklewell Ripper online and, just as often, Googling Strike. On the day before she and Matthew were due to leave for Massam, he arrived home holding a copy of The Sun, which was not his usual read. "Why have you got that?" Matthew hesitated before answering, and Robin's insides twisted. "There hasn't been another..." But she knew there had not been another killing. She had been following the news all day. He opened the paper, folded it to a page about 10 in, and handed it to her, his expression hard to read. Robin found herself staring at her own photograph. She was walking with her head down in the picture, dressed in her trench coat, leaving court after giving evidence at the well-publicized trial of the murderer of Owen Quine. Two smaller pictures were set into her own, one of Strike, looking hungover, the other of the spectacularly beautiful model whose killer they had worked together to catch. Beneath the photo spread were the words, "Landry Detective Seeks New Girl Friday." Cormoran Strike, the detective who solved the murder case of both supermodel Lula Landry and author Owen Quine, has parted company with glamorous assistant Robin Ellicott, 26. The detective has placed an advertisement for the position online. "If you have a background in police or military investigative work and would like to pursue..." There were several more paragraphs, but Robin could not bear to read them. Instead, she looked at the byline, which was that of Dominic Culpepper, a journalist whom Strike knew personally. Possibly he had called Culpepper, who often badgered Strike for stories, and let him have this one, to make sure his need for a new assistant was disseminated as widely as possible. Robin had not thought that she could feel any worse, but now she discovered that she had been mistaken. She really was sacked, after everything that she had done for him. She had been a disposable Girl Friday, an assistant, never a partner, never an equal. And now he was already looking for somebody with a background in the police or the military, somebody disciplined, someone who would take orders. Rage gripped her. Everything blurred, the hall, the newspaper, Matthew standing there trying to look sympathetic, and Robin had to physically resist the impulse to dive into the sitting room where her mobile sat charging on a side table and call Strike. She had thought of doing so many times in the last 4 days, but then it had been to ask, to beg him to reconsider. Not anymore. Now she wanted to shout at him, belittle him, accuse him of base ingratitude, hypocrisy, lack of honour. Her burning eyes met Matthew's, and she saw, before he rearranged his expression, how delighted he was that Strike had put himself so dramatically in the wrong. Matthew, she could tell, had looked forward to showing her the newspaper. Her anguish was nothing compared to his ecstasy at her separation from Strike. She turned away, heading for the kitchen, resolving that she would not shout at Matthew. If they rowed, it would feel like a triumph for Strike. She refused to allow her ex-boss to sully her relationship with the man whom she wanted to marry in 3 days' time. Clumsily dumping a saucepan of spaghetti into a colander, Robin spattered herself with boiling water and swore. "Pasta again," said Matthew. "Yes," said Robin coldly. "Is that a problem?" "God, no," said Matthew, approaching her from behind and putting his arms around her. "I love you," he said into her hair. "I love you too," said Robin mechanically. The Land Rover was packed with everything they would need for their stay up north, for the wedding night at Swinton Park Hotel, and for their honeymoon, somewhere hot, which was all that Robin knew about the destination. They set off at 10 o'clock the following morning, both wearing t-shirts in the bright sunshine, and as Robin got into the car, she remembered that misty morning in April when she had driven away, Matthew in hot pursuit, when she had been desperate to get away, to get to Strike. She was a much better driver than Matthew, but when the two of them had made a journey together, he always took the wheel. Matthew sang Daniel Bedingfield's Never Gonna Leave Your Side as he turned onto the M1. An old song, it dated from the year that they had both started university.
"Could you not sing that?" said Robin suddenly, unable to bear it any longer.
"Sorry," he said, startled. "It seemed appropriate."
"Maybe it's got happy memories for you," said Robin, turning to look out of the window. "But it hasn't for me."
Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Matthew look at her, then turn back to the road. After another mile or so, she wished she had not said anything.
"That doesn't mean you can't sing something else."
"That's all right," he said.
The temperature had fallen slightly by the time they reached Donington Park Services, where they stopped for a coffee. Robin left her jacket hanging over the back of her chair when she went to the bathroom. Alone, Matthew stretched, his T-shirt riding up out of his jeans to reveal a few inches of flat stomach, and drawing the attention of the girl serving behind the Costa coffee bar. Feeling good about himself and life, Matthew grinned and winked at her. She turned red, giggled, and turned to her smirking fellow barista who had seen. The phone in Robin's jacket rang. Assuming that it was Linda trying to find out how close they were to home, Matthew reached lazily across, conscious of the girl's eyes upon him, and tugged the phone out of Robin's pocket. It was Strike. Matthew looked at the vibrating device as though he had inadvertently picked up a tarantula. The phone continued to ring and vibrate in his hand. He looked around. Robin was nowhere to be seen. He answered the call, then immediately cut it. Now calm, missed call was written across the screen. The big ugly bastard wanted Robin back, Matthew was sure of it. Strike had had 5 long days to realize he'd never get anyone better. Maybe he'd started interviewing people for the position and nobody had come close. Or maybe all of them had laughed in his face at the pitiful salary he was offering. The phone rang again. Strike was calling back, trying to make sure that the hanging up had been deliberate rather than accidental. Matthew looked at the mobile, paralyzed with indecision. He dared not answer on Robin's behalf or tell Strike to fuck off. He knew Strike. He'd keep calling back until he spoke to Robin. The call went to voicemail. Now Matthew realized that a recorded apology was the worst thing that could happen. Robin could listen to it again and again and finally be worn down and softened by it. He looked up. Robin was returning from the ladies. With her phone in his hand, he stood up and pretended to be talking into it. "It's Dad," he lied to Robin, placing a hand over the mouthpiece and praying that Strike would not call back again while he was standing in front of her.
"Mine's out of battery. Listen, what's your passcode? I need to look something up for the honeymoon flights. It's to tell Dad."
She gave it to him.
"Give me a sec. I don't want you to hear anything about the honeymoon," he said, and walked away from her, torn between guilt and pride in his own quick thinking.
Once safe inside the men's bathroom, he opened up her phone. Getting rid of any record of Strike's calls meant deleting her entire call history. This he did. Then he called voicemail, listened to Strike's recorded message, and deleted that too. Finally, he went into the settings on Robin's phone and blocked Strike. Breathing deeply, he turned to his handsome reflection in the mirror. Strike had said on the voicemail message that if he did not hear back from her, he would not call again. The wedding was in 48 hours' time, and the anxious, defiant Matthew was counting on Strike keeping his word. Chapter 58. Deadline. He was pumped up, on edge. Pretty sure he had just done something stupid. As the tube train rattled south, his knuckles whitened because he was clutching the hanging strap so tightly. Behind his shades, his puffy, reddened eyes squinted at the station signs. Its shrill voice still seemed to be piercing his eardrum. I don't believe you. Where's the money, then, if you've got night work? No, I want to talk to you. No, you're not going out again. It hit her. He shouldn't have done it, he knew that. The vision of her appalled face was taunting him now, her eyes wide with shock, her hand clamped over the cheek where his finger marks were turning red against the white. It was her own fucking fault. He hadn't been able to stop himself. Not after the last couple of weeks, during which it had become more and more strident. After he'd come home with his eyes full of red ink, he'd pretended to have had an allergic reaction, but there'd been no sympathy from the cold bitch. All it had done was carp about where he'd been, and for the first time, ask where the money was that he claimed to be earning. There hadn't been much time for theft with the boys lately, not with all his time devoted to hunting. She'd brought home a newspaper with a news story in it about the fact that the Shacklewell Ripper might now have red ink stains around his eyes. He had burned the paper in the garden, but he couldn't stop her reading the story elsewhere. The day before yesterday, he thought he'd surprised it, watching him with an odd expression on her face. It wasn't stupid, not really. Was it starting to wonder? This anxiety was the last thing he needed when his attempt on the secretary had left him almost humiliated. There was no point going after the secretary anymore, because she had left Strike forever. He had seen the story online, in the internet cafe, where he sometimes whiled away an hour just to get away from it. He took some consolation from the idea that his machete had frightened her off, that she would bear forever the long scar down her forearm that he had carved there. But that wasn't good enough. His months and months of careful planning had all been with the intention of entangling Strike in murder, tarring him with suspicion. Firstly, embroil him in the death of the stupid little bitch who'd wanted her leg cut off, so that the police swarmed all over him and the dumb public thought he'd had something to do with it. Then murder his secretary. Let him try and limp away from that untainted. Let him try and be the famous detective after that. But the bastard kept wriggling free. There had been no mention of the letters in the press. The letter he had carefully written out from Kelsey, and which had been supposed to turn Strike into suspect number one. Then the press had colluded with the fucker, not giving out the secretary's name, not drawing the connection between her and Strike. Perhaps it might be wise to stop now. Except that he could not stop. He had come too far. He had never in his life put so much planning into anything as he had into the ruination of Strike. The fat, crippled bastard had already advertised for somebody to replace the secretary. And that didn't look like a man who was about to go out of business. One good thing, though. There was no sign of a police presence around Denmark Street anymore. Someone had called them off. They probably thought nobody was needed now that the secretary had gone. Perhaps he ought not to have returned to Strike's place of work, but he had hoped to see the frightened secretary leaving with a box in her hands, or get a glimpse of a downcast, beaten Strike. But no. Shortly after he'd taken up a well-concealed position to watch the street, the bastard had come striding along Charing Cross Road with a stunning-looking woman, apparently completely unperturbed. The girl had to be a temp, because Strike had not had time to interview and hire a permanent replacement. No doubt the big man needed somebody to open his mail. She wore heels that would not have disgraced that little hooker teetering along, waggling a fine arse. He liked them dark. He always had. In fact, given the choice, he'd have taken someone like her any time over the secretary. She hadn't had surveillance training. That much was clear. He had watched Strike's office all morning after his first glimpse of her, watched her nipping out to the post and back, nearly always on the phone, oblivious to her surroundings, so busy tossing her long hair over her shoulders that she was unable to keep eye contact with anyone for long, dropping her keys, gabbling at the top of her voice on her phone, or to anyone else with whom she came into casual contact. At 1 o'clock, he had slipped into the sandwich shop behind her,
and heard her making noisy plans to go to Corsica Studios the following evening. He knew what Corsica Studios was. He knew where it was. Excitement ripped through him. He had to turn his back on her, pretending to look out of the window, because he thought the expression on his face would give it away to all of them. If he did her while she was still working for Strike, he'd have fulfilled his plan. Strike would be connected to two hacked-up women, and nobody, police or public, would ever trust him again. This would be so much easier, too. The secretary had been a fucking nightmare to pick off, always alert and streetwise, going home by crowded, well-lit paths every evening to her pretty boyfriend. But the temp was offering herself up on a plate. After telling the whole sandwich shop where she would be meeting her mates, she had strutted back to work on her perspex heels, dropping Strike sandwiches once on the way. He noticed that there was no wedding or engagement ring on her finger as she bent to pick them up. He had been hard-pressed to suppress his jubilation as he peeled away, formulating his plan. If only he hadn't slapped it, he'd be feeling good now, excited, elated. The slap hadn't been an auspicious start to the evening. No wonder he felt jumpy. There had been no time to stay and calm her down, turn her sweet. He had simply walked out, determined to get to the temp. But he still felt jumpy. What if it called the police? She wouldn't. It had only been a slap. She loved him. She told him so all the time. When they loved you, they let you get away with fucking murder. He experienced a tickling sensation at the back of his neck and looked around with the wild idea that he would see Strike looking at him from the corner of the carriage. But nobody remotely resembling that fat bastard was there, only several ill-kempt men grouped together. One of them, who had a scarred face and a gold tooth, was indeed watching him. But as he squinted back through his shades, the man ceased his scrutiny and returned to fiddling with his mobile. Perhaps he should call it when he got off the tube, before heading for Corsica Studios, and tell it he loved her. Chapter 59. With threats of gas and rose motif. Blue Oyster Cult, before the kiss. Strike was standing in shadow, his mobile in his hand, waiting. The deep pocket of his second-hand jacket, which was far too heavy in the warmth of this June evening, bulged and sagged with the weight of an object he was keen to conceal. What he planned would be best accomplished under cover of darkness, but the sun was taking its time to sink behind the ill-assorted rooftops visible from his hiding place. He knew he ought to be concentrating only upon the dangerous business of the night, but his thoughts kept slinking back to Robin. She had not returned his call. He had set a mental deadline for himself. If she doesn't ring by the end of this evening, she's never calling. At 12 o'clock the following day, she would be getting married to Matthew in Yorkshire, and Strike was sure that constituted a fatal cut-off point. If they did not speak before that ring landed on her finger, he thought that they were unlikely ever to speak again. If anything in the world had been calculated to make him recognize what he had lost, it had been the truculent, noisy presence of the woman with whom he had shared his office for the last few days, staggeringly good-looking though she was. To the west, the sky over the rooftops blazed with colours as bright as a parakeet's wing, scarlet, orange, even a faint trace of green. Behind this flamboyant show came a pale wash of violet, faintly strewn with stars. Almost time to move. As though Shankar had heard his thought, Strike's mobile vibrated, and he looked to see a message. Pint tomorrow? They had agreed on a code. If all of this came to court, which Strike thought overwhelmingly likely, his intention was to keep Shankar well away from the witness box. There must be no incriminating messages between them tonight. Pint tomorrow meant he's in the club. Strike slid the mobile back into his pocket and emerged from his hiding place. crossing the dark car park that lay beneath the deserted flat of Donald Lang. The strata building looked down upon him as he walked. Vast and black, its jagged windows reflecting the last traces of bloody light. Fine netting had been stretched over the front of the balconies of Woolaston Close to prevent birds landing on them and flying in through open doors and windows. Strike moved around at the side entrance, which he had earlier wedged open after a group of teenage girls had left it. Nobody had tampered with the arrangement. People assumed that somebody needed their hands free and feared triggering their wrath. An angry neighbour could be quite as dangerous as an intruder around here, and you had to live with them afterwards. Halfway up the stairs, Strike stripped off his jacket to reveal a fluorescent one. Carrying the first so that it concealed the canister of propane inside, he proceeded on his way, emerging onto the balcony of Lang's flat. Lights shone from the homes sharing the balcony. Lang's neighbours had opened their windows on this warm summer evening so that their voices and the sounds of their TVs floated out into the night. Strike walked quietly past towards the dark, empty flat at the end. Outside the door he had so often watched from the car park, he shifted the gas canister wrapped in his jacket into the crook of his left arm and withdrew from his pocket firstly a pair of latex gloves, which he put on, then a mismatched assortment of tools, some of which belonged to Strike himself, but many of which had been lent for the occasion by Shanker. These included a mortise skeleton key, two sets of jigglers, and assorted comb picks. As Strike set to work on the two locks on Lang's front door, a female American voice floated out into the night through the neighbouring window. "There's the law, and there's what's right. I'm going to do what's right."
"What wouldn't I give to fuck Jessica Alba?"
asked a stoned male voice, to laughter and agreement from what sounded like two other men.
"Come on, you bastard," breathed Strike, fighting with the lower of the two locks and keeping a tight grip on the concealed propane canister. "Move. Move." The lock turned with a loud click. He pushed the door open. As he had expected, the place smelled bad. Strike could make out very little in what looked like a dilapidated and unfurnished room. He needed to close the curtains before turning on the lights. Turning left, he immediately knocked into what felt like a box. Something heavy fell off the top and landed with a crash on the floor. Fuck.
"Oi!"
shouted a voice audible through the flimsy dividing wall.
"That you, Donny?"
Strike hastened back to the door, felt frantically up and down the wall beside the door jamb, and found the light switch. Flooded suddenly with light, the room proved to contain nothing except an old, stained double mattress and an orange box on which an iPod dock had clearly been standing, because it now lay on the ground where it had fallen.
"Donny?"
said the voice, now coming from the balcony outside. Strike pulled out the propane canister, discharged it, and shoved it underneath the orange box. Footsteps from the balcony outside were followed by a knock on the door. Strike opened it. A spotty, greasy-haired man looked hazily at him. He appeared extremely stoned and was holding a can of John Smith's.
"Jesus!"
he said blearily, sniffing.
"It's that fucking smell!"
"Gas," said Strike in his fluorescent jacket, stern representative of the National Grid.
"We've had a report from upstairs. Looks like this is where it's coming from." "Bloody hell," said the neighbour, looking sick. "Not gonna blow up, are we?"
"That's what I'm here to find out," said Strike sententiously. "You haven't got any naked flames next door. Not smoking, are you?"
"I'll go make sure,"
said the neighbour, looking suddenly terrified.
"All right, I might be in to check your place when I finished here," said Strike. "I'm waiting for backup."
He regretted that phrase as soon as it had escaped him, but his new acquaintance did not seem to find such language odd from a gas man. As he turned away, Strike asked,
"Owner's name's Donny, is it?"
Donny Lang, said the jittery neighbour, clearly desperate to go and hide his stash and extinguish all naked flames.